Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. If everybody knows an interest rate hike is coming, probably, maybe, I think so, it is, then why are things so uneasy out there? Uncertainty rears its ugly head yet again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday, today the 14th of December. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. You know how sometimes when you're having a blah kind of day, you can't really put your finger on what it is that's bugging you? That's kind of where we are today in business and the economy. There's the Fed, of course, and their interest rate decision looming on Wednesday. Bond markets are jittery, in part because of the Fed, and in part because of some weird stuff going on in high-yield bonds, junk bonds are also known, about which more later, by the way. Energy is also a bit weird. Oil dipped near 11-year lows this morning before bouncing back. The overseas picture doesn't look so bright either, as it has been for a while now. There is, to use the technical phrase, a whole lot of meh going on out there. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going.
John Addio is in the thick of the swirling market uncertainty.
Every day is an adventure.
Addio is a senior portfolio manager at John Hancock Asset Management. He does some bond buying and says the uncertainty has made him more cautious.
I can't control investor psychology. I can't control, you know, what hedge funds do. But we have to acknowledge that we'll be impacted by those phenomena.
And then there are the folks who sunk money into riskier investments because with low interest rates, safer investments didn't pay much. Now, with the prospect of higher rates soon, they're wondering, what did I do?
Maybe investors got a little bit out in front of their skis.
Aaron Coley is an interest rate strategist at BMO Capital Markets. I reached him on their noisy trading floor.
If you're holding onto the debt of someone who's drilling for oil, you're probably more worried now than you were a few months ago even.
And about those oil markets, they're messing with the Fed's plans to get inflation back up to normal levels.
It's one of the reasons why the inflation numbers are coming in lower than the Fed would like them to.
That's David Weiss, an adjunct professor of economics at Brown University. He says even with the low oil prices and all of the uncertainty, he still expects the Fed to raise rates on Wednesday. Will that calm things down? Nope. Weiss says then investors will start worrying about what the Fed will do next year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
One of the things that's happened in this land of zero interest rates that we've been living in for 7 years now is that investors have gone in search of yield, higher interest rates to get more for their money, which has led them increasingly to what are called junk bonds, non-investment grade bonds that pay more because they are riskier. I mention that because late last week, a company called Third Avenue Management blocked investors from withdrawing their money from one of its junk bond funds, a very big no-no if you're looking to actually, you know, do business on Wall Street. Marketplace's Amy Scott takes this look at the downside of high yield.
Such a negative term, junk.
We've got junk mail, junk food, junk yards.
Edward Altman, a professor at NYU's Stern School of Business, says in the case of bonds, it's an unfortunate term because a lot of the companies that issue high-yield debt are growing and adding jobs. They pay higher interest to compensate investors for the higher risk of default.
Indeed, this is a very good way for them to raise capital, especially of late in the low interest rate environment.
Investors have poured more than $1 trillion into high-yield debt. Duke finance professor Campbell Harvey says that's an unintended consequence of Fed policy.
In artificially pushing down interest rates so low, it's induced people to take risk. And many of these people don't really understand that they're taking this extra risk to get the extra yield.
They haven't needed to understand the risks because default rates have been fairly low, but they're creeping up and expected to get worse. Gershon Distenfeld is director of high-yield investments at Alliance Bernstein. He says investors could see lower returns, and on stocks, too.
Every time the junk bond market's gone down, it's not like this is the first time. This has happened many times. Every time, equities go down more.
reassuring, right? Well, how about this? Altman, the NYU professor, says downturns in the high yield market are usually followed by recessions, and he expects we'll have one within a few years. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On that Fed decision on Wednesday, by the way, if you've got questions about what higher interest rates might mean, we want to hear them. We're going to answer some of your questions on air and online. Ask us at Facebook. We're at Marketplace APM there, or at Twitter. We're just plain at Marketplace there. All right, so back to Amy's story. This probably isn't what you want to hear, but junk bonds got clobbered today. Stocks eked out a win. If equities are your thing, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a relatively obscure government agency that's going to make what could be a high-impact decision this week. We're talking digital music here. The Copyright Royalty Board is set to vote on the rates that internet radio companies have to pay to artists and music labels for the songs they play. Most specifically, we're talking about Pandora, which, although it's been around for 10 years, has yet to turn a profit. Ben Cesario wrote about it for the New York Times. Ben, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, first of all, what this Copyright Royalty Board is. What do they do?
It's a panel of judges in Washington, and they set royalty rates for a whole range of things. And in this case, they're looking at internet radio.
Okay, so specifically then, what is at issue with Pandora and this board?
Pandora pays royalty rates to record companies, and the rate that they pay is set by these judges.
And these are the rates that Pandora pays to artists, studios, whatever, for the right to play their music, right?
That's right. Every 100 times they play a song, they have to pay 14 cents to the music industry. And part of that goes to the record companies, and part of that goes to the artists themselves.
And that seems like not a whole lot of money. I mean, right?
It doesn't sound like it per play, but it adds up to literally hundreds of millions of dollars. Pandora last year paid over $400 million in these royalties. Just the tiniest tweak of these rates really can make a huge difference for Pandora especially, but also for musicians.
Right.
And so that's why they're paying such close attention to this. The litigation has been going on for 2 years now.
Okay, so Pandora presumably wants to pay less. My guess would be that the music business, the music industry, wants them to pay more.
You are exactly right. The music industry wants more money. Pandora wants to pay them less money and has been spending 2 years in court here trying to convince them that it's a good idea. Pandora's argument is basically, if you give us a little bit of a break on the royalty, we'll be able to grow, we'll be more profitable, we'll be able to invest in our business more, and that will, you know, grow digital music generally and make more money for everybody. But the music industry has become a little impatient with Pandora.
What's the difference then between Pandora and Spotify?
Spotify is what's called an on-demand service. You say, all right, I want to listen to this Led Zeppelin song, and you click it and you hear that song. Pandora is like a radio station. So maybe you get a Led Zeppelin song, maybe you get another rock song.
Mm-hmm.
There's a determination that the difference there about being able to choose specifically one song versus not be able to choose a specific song, that there's an economic value to that. It's a very complicated argument, and there have been thousands of pages of legal briefs filed in this over that fact.
And if it goes, say, Pandora's way, then sky's the limit, right? I mean, their growth opportunities are increased and that whole smash.
Well, Pandora has had the rate that they've had now for 6 years, and they've been a public company for 4 years. Pandora is really one of the biggest and most successful digital music companies out there, but they've still never made a profit. Spotify also has not made a profit. It's often thought that Apple is really one of the only companies that's able to do that, and the way they do it is by selling, you know, billions of dollars worth of iPhones.
Right.
So whichever way this royalty goes, you know, how much money can Pandora make and how much money can artists ultimately make?
Ben Cesario covers music for the New York Times. Ben, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Pretty much any way you slice it, what's happened in the Chinese economy in little more than a generation is amazing. They've gone from low-tech, low-skilled manufacturing to the highest-tech electronics that billions of people use every single day. So, why can't they make a good ballpoint pen? It's not me asking. Chinese Premier Li Keqiang said the same thing at a seminar last week in Beijing. He said domestically made pens felt rough compared to pens made in Japan and Germany, and that he wants Chinese pen makers to become more innovative. But as Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports, as with so many things in the Chinese economy, that is harder than it sounds.
It wasn't the first time Li Keqiang complained about his country's shoddy ballpoint pens. After he grumbled about Chinese pens last June, state-run broadcaster CCTV devoted an hour-long program to the topic. On stage were three CEOs of China's most innovative companies. Sitting nervously at a table in front of the studio audience was Qiu Zhiming, president of one of China's largest pen manufacturers. Qiu explained China supplies 80% of the global market for pens, but the core technology of each pen, the stainless steel ball and its casing, is imported from Japan, Germany, or Switzerland. Only Switzerland, he said, has a machine with the precision required to make the best ballpoint pen tips. China, Qiu said sadly, hasn't developed a machine like this. Dong Mingzhu, the CEO of Guli, a Chinese air conditioner manufacturer, frowned at Qiu from her perch on stage.
Think about it. How much money have the foreigners made from us because they have better technology? You don't have this technology, and they're taking your profits. You know what I'm going to do? I'll have my best people make you a machine like the Swiss have. I'll make it in a year and sell it to you for half the price.
Her promise seemed ludicrous. It took years of R&D for the Swiss to make a machine like this, and now she, an air conditioner manufacturer, promised to do the same in months. The CEO next to her, who runs a machine tool company, pointed this out, but the CCTV host quickly shot him down, calling him jealous. Penmaker Qiu shifted in his seat. He smiled uneasily, and knowing full well Premier Li Keqiang would be watching this program, he said the only thing he could muster to such an absurd promise.
I thank you on behalf of the pen manufacturing industry.
I think Li Keqiang is basically trying to shame his people into not being complacent.
Jim McGregor, China CEO of APCO, says Premier Li is sending a message to Chinese manufacturers. Making cheap products is no longer good enough.
He wants them to step up and innovate, which I think some companies are doing.
Companies like Tencent, which makes WeChat a communications app that is leagues ahead of what foreign apps can do, or Huawei, the world's largest telecoms company that's a hub for cutting-edge technology. But where does that leave China's ballpoint pen makers? 40 million pens roll off the assembly line each year at Platinum Pen's factory in Shanghai. Company president Huang Xinhua says he's heard Premier Li's complaints about China's dismal ballpoint pens. I ask him what he thinks.
I guess he must have used a crappy pen. He was probably angry. But not all Chinese pens are bad. Some companies make very good pens.
The problem, says Huang, is the Chinese market. To explain, he takes me to his quality control room, where workers do nothing but click brand new pens all day to make sure they work properly.
We click the pens that'll be sold in China only once, because Chinese consumers are more price conscious. The pens that'll be exported to Japan, we click them twice. They'll pay 20 cents more for a better pen.
But China's marketplace isn't looking for better quality products, Huang says, and he's glad Premier Li is addressing the issue.
In the past, the government praised the big companies that export the most and have the biggest profits. They seldom praise companies that truly make good quality pens.
The question of quantity over quality came up during the CCTV program devoted to ballpoint pens. The host asked the Chinese CEOs on stage a simple question.
Okay, take 3 seconds and think of an innovative product that is uniquely Chinese.
First up was a CEO of a robotics company.
If I close my eyes and try to think of a product that has Chinese characteristics and is recognized internationally, I can't think of one.
Qiu Zhiming, the CEO of the ballpoint pen company, was no longer in the hot seat. He sat quietly watching the CEOs on stage stammer answers to this essential question, and he smiled. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Really, the strong dollar has such a greater impact on what we're doing every day that a slight increase in interest rates I don't think is going to affect anything.
How the Fed raising rates might affect businesses, or might not. I don't know. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 103.6%, closed at 17,368. Today, the NASDAQ gained 18 points, more than a third percent, 49.52. The S&P 500 traded up 9 points, 0.4%, 2,021 there. All right, so you had to figure this one was coming. Dozens of nations, hundreds really, reached a deal over the weekend to find ways to stop global warming. And today, shares in coal producers took it on the chin. Peabody Energy Corporation off 13%. Cloud Peak Energy down 11%. To name just two. Companies involved in solar, though, did see a boost. Sunrun beamed up 15%. Solar City up 12% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note is up to 2.22%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported, so please, to keep our coverage relevant and compelling, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st, and thanks. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's a natural gas leak out here in Southern California that's making some news, both for its size. The Air Quality Board out here figures it's boosting California's greenhouse gas output by 25%, but also for its sheer intractability. The leak from an underground storage system about 30 or so miles northwest of downtown L.A. started back in October, and the gas company says it's going to be months more before it can be plugged. Ingrid Lobet from Inside Energy explains how that can be.
The mainly methane gas is blowing hundreds of feet into the air near a damaged well used to inject natural gas into a vast underground storage area. The field is operated by Southern California Gas Company, the region's gas utility. Pilots have been told by the FAA to stay clear of the plume for fear of ignition.
I think what we're seeing is probably one of the largest single releases of methane in California state history.
Tim O'Connor used to inspect major facilities like refineries. He works for the Environmental Defense Fund.
People I speak with that are experts in the field say that this is the biggest, most complex leak that they have ever seen.
Authorities estimate the rupture in the well, perhaps more than a mile deep, is sending 100,000 pounds of methane into the air per hour. Methane traps heat more powerfully than carbon dioxide, giving it an outsized role in rising sea levels and disrupted weather. Jillian Wright is vice president for customer services for the gas company.
We never have had an escape this large, and I have to really emphasize this is an extremely rare event. The extent and the difficulty of resolving this leak are highly, highly unusual.
All the methods the company has tried so far to kill the well have failed. Now experts from the Kuwaiti oil field fires have joined the effort. The safety of some 100 workers on the site is also a major concern.
That is why on certain days when the wind is high, we've not been able to do certain work. If the wind is blowing methane over certain equipment, we can't start that equipment.
More than 3,000 families, ill or frightened by sulfurous gas drifting down from the site, have sought relocation, paid for by the gas company. Those include George Chang and Susan Gorman Chang.
I'm an avid jogger. I would jog 5 miles every other night, but I stopped because the last time
I was way up the street, and then the smell comes, and there's no place to go. You still have to jog home. And I was really, really dizzy the next morning.
Then one recent Sunday morning before church, she says, she opened the back door to let the dog out and was sickened by gas. Now the Changs reside in an extended stay hotel with a mini kitchen, no oven. Some of her fellow refugee neighbors consider getting air filters, but that gives her mixed feelings.
Gosh, are we in one of those sci-fi movies where you run from your car to your home and you can never go outside and you can't exercise outside or walk your pets because the air's become toxic? How is that okay?
Several lawsuits have already been filed. Steve Boland, the scientist who heads up the California Oil and Gas Agency, says it is completely focused on the massive release.
It has consumed the attention of this division to make sure the company moves quickly and appropriately to get it sealed. We have directed them to drill a relief well. We are directing them to prepare for a second relief well.
But the oil and gas chief says if the state is too directive, it could be liable for consequences. And with the release of a gas that's made to burn, the risk is considerable.
This is Southern California Gas's problem to fix.
Many researchers say no one has really been paying attention to these underground gas storage fields, preoccupied with strengthening regulations on pipelines and wells and the other places harmful methane escapes. Again, Tim O'Connor of the Environmental Defense Fund.
You know, when we look at how much is coming out of this facility, you know, the fact that it's equal to like 6 coal-fired power plants, how much they would put out every hour, or 7 million extra cars driving on the road, it's really just a testament to how big this thing is. I think we found a regulatory gap. Unfortunately, we've got a huge problem staring us in the face.
I'm Ingrid Lobet for Marketplace.
Ingrid's report comes to us from iNews Source. That's an investigative journalism nonprofit out of San Diego. If we were going to bet on how the economy's doing, you and I would give you all the analysts and pundits and experts that you want, and I would side with regular people out there every single time. The ones living it day in and day out, both individually and in terms of what it does for small businesses. With the strong, shall we say, likelihood that the Fed's going to raise interest rates this week, we've done some calling around to our regulars. Lisa Goldenberg is the president of the Delaware Steel Company. Lisa, it's good to talk to you again.
Great to be together.
Before I get to the question du jour about interest rates, how's business? How's it going for you out there?
I would say it's sort of mediocre. I never say lousy because you know me, I'm an optimist, yes. But it's borderline lousy if ever I could get away with those words.
Well, what's going on?
I think that the economy has really slowed down, and this giant freight train that I've been telling you about, the little engine that could, that tries to go up the hill, it's chugging, but it's taken some steps back. And aside from world terror that has everyone pretty shaken up, I think that industry as a whole has really slowed down. The administration has made some efforts to improve, but they're minimal and they're not enough and they're not fast enough. And we in the steel industry are taking a beating.
I have to tell you, I'm so glad we called you, because in a day and a half or 2 days or whatever it is, Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve are going to officially say, you know what, the economy is strong enough for us to raise interest rates, make money more expensive. Do you agree with that? And what's that going to mean for your business life?
Well, I agree with doing something. Something's got to get done. Doing nothing is unacceptable, and we've had a lot of doing nothing. After all, we've had low interest rates for years now, and they can't stay low for forever. They have to come back up. But it's almost immaterial. It's not going to be enough to really do much. We all love cheap money, but really the strong dollar has such a greater impact on what we're doing every day that a slight increase in interest rates, I don't think, is going to affect anything.
Well, talk to me about that for a second. You do a lot of exporting. Obviously, you're in a global steel market. The strength of the dollar is, at a step or two removed from interest rates. How worried are you about that?
Well, the strong dollar for me is pretty much a disaster. There is no export when there's a strong dollar. So all the opportunity we have to ship other countries that we were doing for many, many, many years, not just my business, but many of my peers, we have all this all these goods coming into our country and there's no opportunity to get it out because the dollar is just too high to trade in dollars. I look at that as a much greater predictor than a slight increase to interest rates.
One more thing, and then I'll get out of your hair. We've been doing a bunch of stories about how the economy feels to individual people and how those economies make up the bigger national economy. So the question to you is, how does your economy feel to you right now, day in and day out?
A struggle. If I had to pick one word, it would be struggle. I don't think it's uncertainty. It's just it's a grind. It takes twice or three times as much effort to do half as much. So it's and you have to be smarter and leaner and tougher. So it's a struggle. It really is.
Lisa Goldenberg, she runs the Delaware Steel Company. We talked to her quite a bit. Lisa, thanks very much.
Great. Happy holidays.
All right. So the Fed is maybe, probably, kind of, sort of, who knows, going to raise rates on Wednesday. We're answering your questions about it on air and online. Ask us anything you want to know about how interest rates might affect your life. Get us on Facebook. We are Marketplace APM. Final note on the way out today. Good news and bad news, I guess you could say. The good news is that according to Play Network, Mariah Carey no longer has the most played Christmas song out there. Of course, All I Want for Christmas Is You. Surely you have heard it. The bad news is that we have some bent-up demand, people, for new Christmas songs because the new most played song of this season is The Shins doing a 2012 remake of Paul McCartney's Wonderful Christmas Time, which is Oh, come on, like 35 years old or something. Somebody write something, all right? We'll be having, come on, that's a terrible song too. All right, the Dow up 103.6%. The NASDAQ gained 18 points, more than a third of 1%. The S&P 500 up 9 points, 0.4%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.